Chapter 10. At 10 minutes of midnight, July 16th, 4748, Isher, the door of the coordination department of the weapon makers in the Hotel Royal Genil opened. Robert Hedrock came out and strode along a wide, bright corridor that stretched off into the distance ahead of him. He moved with an almost cat-like alertness, but actually his attention was not on his surroundings. Little more than a year ago, he had applied for weapon shop membership, his given reason being that he expected a crisis between government and weapon shop forces, and that he desired to be on the weapon shop side. His papers were in order. The P sub P machine gave him so high a rating in every mental, physical, and moral category that his file was immediately brought to the attention of the weapon shop executive council. From the beginning, he was on special duty, and his assignment to the coordination department during an emergency was merely a normal step in his meteoric rise to weapon shop power. Hedrock was aware that a few members of the council and a number of the top executives considered his ascent too rapid and not in the best interests of the weapon shops. That he was even regarded by some as a mysterious figure, though no sinister connotations were intended by the critics. No one actually questioned the verdict of the P sub P machine in his favor, which puzzled him at times. At some later date, he decided, he would investigate the machine much more carefully and discover just why normally skeptical men accepted its judgments without question. It had proved inordinately simple for him to fool it, lie to it, tell it his carefully doctored story. True, he had special control of his mind and abnormal technical knowledge of machine reaction to biological processes. There was also the overruling fact of his friendliness to the weapon shops, which undoubtedly helped. The P sub P machine, he had been told, had the weapon shop door's unique sensitivity for recognizing hidden hostility, and its basic structure included the ability, also built into every gun, to recognize and react within limitation. Like the weapons that would not kill except in self-defense or under other restrictions, its intricately acute electronic senses perceived minute differences in the reactions of every part of the examined body. It was an invention that had been developed since the last time he had been a member of the weapon shops 100-odd years before. It was new to him, and their dependence on it made it necessary for Robert Hedrock, Earth's one immortal man, friend of the weapon shops, to make sure it was as effective a safeguard as they thought. But that was for later. It was the least of the problems confronting him. He was a man who had to make up his mind. How soon was not yet clear, but all too soon, it seemed to him. The first great attack of the youthful Empress had already closed the weapon shops in every large city on Earth. But even that was secondary compared to the problem of the endless seesaw. He could not escape the conviction that only he, of all the human beings on Earth, was qualified to make the decision about that. And he still had not an idea of what to do. His thought reached that point as he came to the door marked Private Executives Only, his destination. He knocked, waited the necessary seconds, then entered without further preliminary. It was a curiously arranged room in which he found himself. Not a large room by Isher standards, but large enough. It was so close to being a 200-foot cube that Hedrock's eyes could not detect the difference. Its most curious feature was that the door, through which he entered, was about 100 feet above the floor, with the ceiling an equal distance higher. There was a platform just inside the door. From it projected an energy plane. Hedrock stepped into one of the pairs of insulators on the platform. The moment he felt them grip his shoes, he walked out onto the vaguely glowing latticework of force. In the center of the room, center on height, depth, as well as length, width level, 7 weapon shop counselors were standing around a machine that floated in a transparent plastic case. They greeted Hedrock briefly, then returned their attention to the machine. Hedrock watched them silently, conscious of their intense, unnormal depression. Beside him, Peter Cadran whispered, "It's almost time for another swing." Hedrock nodded, and slowly, as he gazed at the wizard mechanism floating in its vacuumized case, their absorption communicated itself to him. It was a map of time. A map of intercrossed lines so finely drawn that they seemed to waver like heat waves on a torrid day. Theoretically, the lines extended from a central point into the infinite past and the infinite future, with the limitation that in the mathematics employed, infinity was almost zero. But after several trillion years, the limitation operated to create a blurred effect, which was enhanced by the unwillingness of the eyes to accept the image. On that immense ocean of time, the shadowy shapes, one large and very near the center, one a mere speck on the curving vastness of the map, lay moveless. Hedrock knew that the speck was a magnified version of the reality, which was too small to make out with the naked eye. The image had been so organized that its every movement was followed by a series of magnifiers. These instruments were attuned to separate sensitive energies and adjusted automatically to the presence of additional onlookers. As Hedrock watched with pitying eyes, both shadows moved. It was a movement that had no parallel in macrocosmic space, a movement so alien that the vision could not make an acceptable image. It was not a particularly swift process, but in spite of that, both shadows withdrew? Where? Even the weapon shop scientist had never quite decided that. They withdrew and then slowly reappeared, but now their positions were reversed with variations. They were farther out. The large shadow, which had been wavering 1 month and 3 days from the center in the past, was suddenly 1 month and 3 days and a few hours in the future. The tiny speck, which had been 97 billion years in the future, reversed to about 106 billion years in the past. The time distance was so colossal that Hedrock shrank in spite of himself and half turned to Cadran. Have they figured out his energy potential? Cadran nodded wearily. Enough to destroy the planet. He groaned. Where in the name of space are we going to release it? Hedrock tried to picture that. He had not been among those who talked to McAllister, the reporter from the 20th century. His understanding of what had happened had been pieced together from fragmentary accounts, and one of his purposes in coming to this room now was to learn the details. He drew Cadran aside and frankly asked for information. Cadran gazed at him with a wry smile. All right, he said. I'll tell you. The truth is, all of us are ashamed of the way we acted. Hedrock said, Then you feel that McAllister should not have been sacrificed? Cadran shook his head. No, that isn't exactly what I mean. His frown deepened. I guess the best method is to tell you the whole story, briefly, of course. He began. The girl attendant of the Greenway shop heard someone come and went out to attend to him. The customer was a queer-looking chap in outlandish clothes. It turned out that he was a newspaper reporter from the 20th century A.D., He was so obviously disconcerted, so fascinated by the showcase with their energy guns. And he gave an account of a weapon shop having appeared in a street in a little city in which he lived. I can imagine the sensation it caused, but the truth is that everybody thought it was an illusion of some kind. It seemed solid, of course, but when the police tried to open the door, naturally it wouldn't open. McAllister, with the reporter's curiosity, finally tried the door himself. For him, of course. He not being a police or government official, it opened immediately. He went inside. He admitted to the attendant, experiencing a sense of tension as he crossed the threshold, and although he didn't know it, it was at that moment that he picked up the first measure of time energy, the equivalent of approximately 7,000 years, his weight being the other factor. When the attendant told her father, who was in charge of the shop, what had occurred, he realized immediately that something was wrong. In a few minutes, he had verified that the shop was being subjected to titanic energy pressure. He discovered that the source of the energy was the huge government building on an adjacent street. He immediately called the weapon makers into council. By the time we arrived on the scene, a swift decision was necessary. McAllister had enough time energy locked up in his body to destroy the entire city. That is, if he ever stepped outside our insulated shop without himself being insulated. Meanwhile, the pressure from the government building against our shop continued unabated. At any moment, it might succeed in precipitating the shop itself into the time stream, and there was reason to believe that other attacks would be made at any moment on our shops everywhere. No one could guess what the result would be. To cut a long story short, we saw a way to gain time by focusing the energy of the building upon McAllister and tossing him back into his own time. We could do this by putting him into an insulated spacesuit, which would prevent him from exploding until we could develop a mechanism for that purpose. We knew that he would seesaw back and forth in time, shifting the government building and its energies out of this space-time area. Cadran shook his head gloomily. I still don't see what else we could have done. We were compelled to act swiftly in a field where no great knowledge is available. And the fact that we merely got out of the frying pan and into the fire was just our hard luck. but personally, I feel very badly about the whole thing. Do you think McAllister is still alive? Hedrock asked. Oh, yes. The suit into which we put him was one of our supers, complete with an 8-ring food-making device, and there's a cup in it that's always full of water. The other facilities are equally automatic. He smiled a twisted smile. We had an idea, completely false as it turned out, that we could save him at some later date. I see, said Hedrock. He felt depressed. It was unfortunate, but all the decisions had been made before he had even heard of the danger. The newsman was now the juggernaut of juggernauts. In all the universe, there had never been anything like the power that was accumulating, swing by swing, in his body. Released, the explosion would rock the fabric of space. All time would sigh to its echoes, and the energy tensions that created the illusion of matter might collapse before the strain. What's the latest about the building? Hedrock asked. Cadran was more cheerful. It's still within its critical limits. We've got to make our decision before it reaches the danger stage. Hedrock was silent. The matter of what the decision should be was a sore point with him, who was obviously not going to be asked. He said finally, What about the men who are working on the problem of slowing the swings and bringing the seesaw back this way? Another man answered that. The research is abandoned. Science 4784 has no answer. We're lucky enough to have made one of our shops the fulcrum. We can set off the explosion anywhere in the past or future. But which and when? Particularly when? The shadows on that cartograph made no movement, gave no sign. Their time of action was not yet.